Greetings, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this episode on climate financing, with a particular focus on a report, actually, that was launched by AfriCatalyst this September of 2023. This was actually termed Debt for Climate Swaps, which provides significant pathways to unlocking climate finance on the continent. I'm Arnold Segawa, and I'll be your guide through this particular conversation, which I, for one, think is a very, very timely, as we do break down the complexities around debt for climate swaps on the African continent. On this particular podcast, we will be having some interesting and insightful analysis on the subject by building on the findings of the report, of course, while exploring potential opportunities and challenges that could derail its implementation. Now, to help us unpack this particular complexities, to give us more insight on the findings of the report, allow me to introduce Paolo Zacchia, who will just break down some of the findings and what this actually means for the continent. Thank you for joining us, Paolo.
Really glad to be on this podcast with you, Arnold, and really excited to be able to break down some of the findings of the report we wrote with Dauda Semben on this topic of repurposing and upscaling and upsizing debt for climate swaps as a climate finance instrument.
If you were to just try to break down this particular topic, how would you explain it to someone who has never heard of it?
Well, I think what comes out from the last years of climate finance is a lot of declaration about how much money is needed, very large sum, some amount of commitment that is not as much as what is needed, and then the real amount of money that actually made available is very little. And I think that's the starting point which is really needed to be addressed, is how do we get some real action on climate finance? Because climate finance, a lot of it is going into mitigation, that is energy transition mainly in transport, transition in high-income economies, but there's very little of it going for adaptation where it hurts the most, which is in lower-income country, in particularly African country, which are bearing the brunt of climate change, very often with population with already, which are affected by high levels of poverty and income insecurity. So the real challenge is really how do we get this hybrid climate finance discussion to really mean something at the grassroots level where the impact are being felt today.
Paolo, if we're to bring in COP28, which actually was just underway just the other day, how can we segue some of the conversations that were actually happening at COP28 to have particular relevance on the report that, of course, AfriCatalyst just put out?
Well, I think at COP28, you have two big streams of conversations, and the report will basically align very strongly with one of the two. So one, of course, is about all this discussion about how do you actually bring down carbon levels and to a manageable level. And so it's more about energy transition, phasing out or phasing down fossil fuel. So that discussion there. But then there's a second discussion that while we do that, and that will take many years, many decades, the impacts are already being felt. And so there's an element of equity, justice, and even overall productivity of the world economy, in which we really need to help the countries which have received the highest impact of those actual climate changes with adaptation, that it to make their population more resilient to the actual impact of climate change, whether it's flooding, whether it's droughts, whether it's increased salination of water. All these things are happening and putting a lot of pressure and hurting some of the poorest population, many of which are in Africa. So this discussion about adaptation, about equity, is really happening also at COP28. And people are asking, where is the money? Where are the instruments to make this climate adaptation money viable and flowing very quickly?
Of course, given the urgency of mobilizing much of this climate finance for adaptation on the African continent, where then does debt for climate swaps, where does that fit in? I mean, in this grand global picture of Global South and the North?
So I think it fits with the theme I mentioned initially. How do you get real action? And to get real action, and not only declaration, not only studies and analysis of how much is needed, but actual money flowing, you need to find the intersection between the amount of money which is needed, what people have committed to give, and what's realistic from a political economy perspective. And when you look at these three spheres and you look at their intersection, it's not really highly populated. So we were trying to find something that could inhabit that intersection. And we think that if you repurpose an old instrument, which are debt for nature swaps, into a newer, updated instrument, which we call debt for climate swaps, then you might have a very strong candidate to be both meeting the commitment of high-income economies towards adaptation and then being politically realistic.
Of course, we cannot rule out some of the earlier commitments that have been made over the years. I mean, we saw, let's say, debt for nature swaps that have been around for quite a while. But what's new, I mean, in this particular proposition that you're putting forward?
I think that's the critical point in the report is that in the past, debt for nature swaps were important, but they've remained a specialized marginal instrument. And that for at least, I would say, three reasons. One is that they had a very narrow on environmental conservation. What we say is that we need now to move from conservation to climate adaptation, also to loss and damage funding, and to broader climate goal, whether it's biodiversity. So we need to broaden the scope of the instrument from conservation. The second thing is that instrument, that swap, was seen mainly as an instrument for debt relief, that it was adapted only for country which had a debt problem. We say, no, you can use it for any country which has debt. Any low-income or developing country which has a debt should be able to access this instrument. And that's why, and that's the third element, that rather than being seen as a unilateral instrument where creditor nation forgives the debt of a developing country, you can see it as a balanced transaction, basically made commitment about their, let's say, accountability for climate change, and they need to disburse a certain amount of money, and they disburse it by basically forgiving the debt of the country. So it becomes a balanced transition rather than a one-way transition, but still doesn't cost any new money to the creditor country, and then to require the developing country that's using the money for climate finance to get a loan, but it's basically money that was already in the books. So this instrument is really new on these three dimensions. And once you implement these three new elements, it could really meet the challenge of leveraging a lot of money relatively quickly for climate adaptation and broader climate goals.
Of course, with any report, there are always challenges or hindrances that arise from the findings of the report. Well, what would you say is a critical challenge that you actually uncovered here?
Well, I think the critical challenge is that at the core of debt for climate swaps, there's a fundamental mismatch in terms of the time profile of the two sides of the bargain. So debt cancellation is a one-shot event. And while climate finance, especially climate adaptation, is something that's more similar to an investment program, a medium to long-term spending to alleviate the impact of climate change, to make population more resilient, prepare for the worst. So it does take a long effort over time. So what we say is that you need to find a mechanism that allows to resolve this mismatch. And that's one, let's say, the second part of the report, after making the case that that's really a relevant instrument for climate adaptation and that it is really at this intersection of realism and it's needed. We make the case that by finding the right mechanism to address the mismatch, then the instrument could be quite widely adapted. But definitely, it needs a champion. I think that's one of the main issues, even with the COP28, is that there are so many issues, so many proposals, that no one proposal can go ahead if it doesn't find the right kind of champion and attention. So I think what we're doing today also is trying to publicize a bit the idea, hoping that some people will pick it up and think, oh, this is something really run with and bring the attention of people towards this kind of instrument to have something really going on relatively quickly, while we make the big instrument that are needed, but will take years and years to be ready. While we design those instruments, we can really run with it in the very short term.
I mean, listening to you talk there, I was just thinking out loud and, I just figured, to what extent is this particular conversation undone by a lack of statistics? I bring this up because, I mean, over the years we've heard, take for instance, methane output across the developed world or versus developing worlds. How hard is it for us to have a conversation around financing vis-a-vis climate financing when statistics, let alone the developing world, but even the developed world, statistics are meager, to say the least?
Yeah, I think you have a great point, and that definitely the fact that the statistics on climate adaptation, climate finance are in a very early stage. So when you have to make the case, I would say more academically, it's a little bit more difficult to really get the data to really support your case. But some of the macro statistics are there, and we know that climate finance is lacking for adaptation. We know that the pledges made by high-income economy, the Copenhagen and commitment, and also some of the commitment towards a loss and damage fund that have been made are not funded. So on that one, at the macro level, it's very clear. So I think in the paper, we try to move from research perspective where the data debate could be tricky to a more policy oriented, where you say, well, we have enough to try to find something that works and that brings real action to the horizon.
Thank you for that, Paolo. I mean, that takes us to the other question, which is, of course, the role of private creditors in this entire conversation. I mean, we saw at COP28, civil society is very, very heavy in this. There's a lot of conversations going around that. Civil society is trying to do its best, but where do private creditors actually come into this particular conversation?
Yeah, I think private creditors have been important, but if you look again at the data we were discussing before, I think although there's some scarcity of data, what it shows is that most of the private finance is going towards one, energy climate mitigation, which means mainly energy projects like renewable energy, because those are bankable projects, and it comes under the form of credit, so loans, whether they are subsidized or not subsidized. In the area of climate adaptation and even of climate swaps, the role of private finance has been marginal. So I think you're totally right saying the scope to really expand it. But I think in that area, differently from maybe energy production, like renewable energy, private finance will be a follower rather than a leader. So this new instrument, the debt for climate swaps, have to be at the beginning really established by government. It's a bilateral group of creditor and a developing country. And once they create that infrastructure of a climate for nature swap, then the private sector could come in and say, oh, part of that adaptation program, we are ready to take it, because the private sector needs a framework to enter this kind of adaptation finance. It needs to have also a narrative that can go back to its board or to its customers to say, we are doing something that makes sense. So to create that context, I think the debt for climate swaps could really be very important. And then, as we say, the private sector could tag in along and take chunks of the program and provide in private sector financing to that. But it will have to be in a polar fashion.
What would you say are other instruments that could actually complement the debt for climate swaps?
Well, I think there's a carbon finance, if it's revitalized, if it's more liquidity and security is given to a market, could really be very complementary to that and could fit into what I was saying before of the private sector finding within an adaptation program, adaptation and mitigation program areas where it could basically implement some carbon finance instruments.
I mean, it's interesting you brought in the carbon bit, because it just leads me to another question. You know, there's been a lot of talk of why actually carbon credits failed across much of the continent. What can be done to make sure that we don't see the same demise of carbon credits with this particular approach?
Well, I think on that one, you'd need a full podcast to address this issue. I think it's a very complex issue. and also with very strong opinion. And myself, I'm not really a specialist, so I'm more of a consumer of news on that one, on carbon finance. But I think you need to fix the system in general, and then you need some specific instrument that provide the infrastructure or the security for private sector to operate. So I think where the instrument we are proposing fits in would be in the second category. You know? It cannot fix the overall carbon finance issues, but then it can provide a context where it's more secure, it's more understandable, it's more viable for the instrument, a renewed carbon finance mechanism to be implemented.
Well, any final remarks on the report?
Yeah, I think the report is not very technical, so I just encourage readers to go through it and go more into the details, and especially if they're interested in this issue of equity of climate finance, and also on the issues of where do we get real action. So the report is really easy to read. It's not too technical, but it does provide some detailed element on data and on the institutional mechanisms. So it's something can be a good read for people who have an interest in the topic.
Paolo, a pleasure to have you on, and thank you for joining us. I understand it's already, we're a few hours apart. He's in Singapore, I'm in Johannesburg. But thank you so much, Paolo Zakia, for joining us for this particular podcast. You can always join us for more insightful conversations across the continent as we unpack very many issues. I'm Arnold Segawa. Thank you again for joining us. Until next time, thank you.